I have no witty comments. Their theme song right now just completely rules here on DJ Please. A heinous trip of Warp 5. My name is Joseph.
And I'm your evil co-host, Peter. And introducing our special guest star, Jolene Blaylock's abs.
Look, I mean, there's so much to talk about today, Peter. Obviously, we're starting things off right. That incredible theme song that you heard was actually produced by Ian, who has worked with Sarah, his wife in the past, for on our theme songs that are purposefully bad recorder covers of Trek themes. But in the sort of mirror universe, mixing it up, you know, backwards is forwards sense of it, he did one that fucking rules so much harder than the original.
Which was already a vast improvement. Boy, let's get into it, right?
Yeah, what did we watch?
Season 4, episode 18, In a Mirror, Darkly. First aired the 22nd of April, 2005. Written by Mike Sussman, directed by James Conway. This is set in Stardate April 5th, 2060. Not Stardate, this is just, we're still on Earth dating. Boy, oh boy.
It was so much more than you were expecting, wasn't it?
It was, and this is the first time I've really come near anywhere these episodes. All you got to do is look at the Memory Alpha entry, right? Which is normally... Yeah.
Possibly the longest I've ever seen.
If this is an entire season worth of any other of Enterprise's shows together into one... This is so very clearly the episode of the two episodes of Enterprise that the public at large gives any fucks about whatsoever. Like, and the entire show may as well just be a basket that these two episodes have been placed in.
And that would be enough to entertain. I mean, these are a incredible love letter to the deepest Trek cuts imaginable, and it's very much the kind of product that they produced at the end of DS9 as well, of stuff that's just handcrafted, artisanal made for the deepest of Star Trek fans, and it fucking rules. This thing is awesome.
Not even the deepest of fans, because I never watched Mirror, right? Mm-hmm. I'm aware vaguely of what happens in it. I read, I think it was called Dark Mirror, which was the TNG Mirror Universe entry or whatever.
Right. The one where Troy is like a psychic inquisitor.
Psychic Gestapo, right? Yeah. And I think Barclay's like, everybody's from Lancaster, nobody gets sleeves. But you know, I don't have tons and tons and tons of Mirror Universe lore. There's all the shit that unfortunately Discovery dragged me through,
doesn't count really.
Right. But sitting here and watching this show for four seasons, and really all I got to do is watch two or three episodes to understand where these characters are for the most part, which has been, you know, a major complaint for me is that they're kind of shallow placeholder characters. You get varying degrees of interest and depth from time to time, and some characters are able to consistently portray more there, like the Doctor or Trip. But by and large, you watch one episode of Enterprise, you know exactly who everybody is, and that's all you need to do to see, to go into this and be like, wow, there's wild differences all over the place. And old Brandon Braga here was highly impressed with this episode's teaser sequence, later stating, when I saw that, I was like, this should just be a whole season. Yeah, it should have been season 1 and 2 instead of the fucking garbage you gave us, Bran.
Would have been a huge improvement. I mean, this was a very well-crafted idea. They had a really good sense of what they wanted to do. And when I say artisanally crafted, though, it's like, you have to really love Trek to decide, like, we're going to bet the farm on these things as a sequel to the Tholian web. a TOS episode that's iconic for some images, but I guarantee you is something that a lot of people haven't seen. Right? Like what? Yeah. Like you didn't need all of that context to enjoy it. And that's great. It's just good. But as someone who, you know, grew up watching the original series and that this is what happened to the Defiant, this is what occurred during the Tholian Web, is that it slipped into a different universe, just like Spock said. And here it is in the hands of past Tholians.
What blew my mind on all of this is that the premise of this episode initially existed as a way to get Bill Shatner on the set.
Oh, yeah. That was a fantastic whole idea of its own about how Archer essentially becomes responsible for the origin of the mirror universe. Because there's a point of divergence, and it's like a past version of Kirk played by Shatner and all that.
I think that would have been phenomenal. And Bill Shatner, you know, having just watched Khan and reviewed it and all the discussion we put in there, you know, you go to StarTrek.com, you look at some of the Paramount official imagery, Kirk is absent from a lot of these, like, eras collages, you know?
Sure is.
And they'll do stuff like there's Spock, who is arguably the most recognizable Star Trek character across the board, right? But then there's, like, Uhura, and it's like, where's Kirk at? Come on, like, I'm not taking anything away from Uhura, but certainly within the body of work that is original series, Uhura is not a fucking main character there, right? Like, it's easy to fall in this trap of just like, oh, there's this political agenda and Kirk represents the patriarchy and we got to delete him, blah, 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 blah. And that's an easy hole to kind of fall down. But then, you know, there's shit like this where it's like, hey, man, we made a whole fucking badass story arc just to get you on set for this, the last entry into Berman era Trek. And because you were such a fucking prick, you couldn't work it out with Paramount for whatever ungodly money you were probably asking for, other unreasonable demands, and that whole thing had to be scrapped. So when I see his picture missing in like a Star Trek banner on StarTrek.com, are they trying to cancel Kirk, or is it just Shatner being a prick about his likeness and not, you know, willing to let them use it without paying him $1 million?
He has the ego that you would imagine he has, right? Like, it's a shame he couldn't allow himself to be involved with the thing that made him one more time. But it is what it is. And instead, they made this. This is great. You know what? Let's get into it. The teaser that you mentioned that Brandon Braga watched. What they do is take the film roll from First Contact of Zefren Cochrane going out to meet with the Vulcans after they have detected the warp signature from the Phoenix. And about two-thirds of the way through, suddenly you kind of have one little cut to it, obviously a TV shot, because it's not, doesn't have the film grain anymore.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, something different's about to happen here, something weird. The Vulcans come out, they say, live long and prosper, and then, you know, Zefren Cochrane gets his gat handy, blows the guy away, and they loot the place.
Wow. You know, that. Why did Zefren Cochrane not shoot the Vulcans originally with a sawed-off shotgun? Is it because he was a visionary who was ready to usher humanity into its next phase? Is it because the crew of the Enterprise had time, the E had time traveled back, and he's basically been friendship coached by Riker and company into becoming the person that would have need? Is there some weird timey-wimey stuff? Is the mirror universe the baseline and, you know, traditional Trek a variant because of time travel and basically a self-fulfilling loop of some sort? Interesting stuff, because I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that those people living in a post-apocalyptic shithole wouldn't have just shot the aliens and stolen all their stuff.
A very realist interpretation of what First Contact Day could have looked like, for certain. Mm-hmm. And then it's followed up by a
the credit sequence that we should have always had. It is a soft, synthy, but still, you know, rock and roll instrumental in the background. And instead of the peaceful Encarta, we have all the cool articles in the Encarta with like wars and guns and missiles and shit.
It's these guys sitting around like, you know, what if we just went full Command and Conquer Red Alert?
Yeah, this is the one where we should use the Hell March.
Mm-hmm. Jet fighters. I love the what's it called, an Emmett class starship that's, you know, in the regular one, like, oh look, here's our first real starship, and it's like
bombing
orbital striking the moon. Yeah. Also in there is the it's from Dragon's Teeth when the Vardwar's homeworld is getting bombed.
Oh, it's and that they reuse that.
Yep.
Oh, that's so funny.
In fact, you were wrong, Joe. That was not the only time we would ever see the Vardwar. They do get used in actually two episodes of Star Trek. I would say this, you know, marks the first time Enterprise has ever had an A-plus intro.
Yes, well, first and only.
And it's funny, too, because, I mean, these intros cost money. And Enterprise has been so fucking bad. Like, it's finally the What If episode where they allow the intro that is god awful just to be completely fucking thrown out. Like, whoever's butt would be hurt about this thing that has been the reason that it's had a stranglehold on four fucking seasons of this show.
They finally have to eat it, right? They just finally have to accept that they didn't use it.
We're not spitting in your face, man. It's just a fun what if episode. Like, you know, yeah, what if we had to go with a
different vibe? You know, it's we're causing immersion by making it different.
Listen, Rod Stewart, you know everybody loves you, but hey, man, just this one time, Todd Stewart. but anyways, so the money constraints on this, right? A lot of corner cutting this season to save money.
Oh, yeah.
You see where it's all gone now. How funny. It's just the What If Elseworlds episode. And even on this, the budget is so fucking tight that by the end, when Forrest is alone on the bridge,
mm-hmm.
they had to put Hoshi there so he could have someone to talk to, because the idea of paying an extra to be able to talk was so prohibitively expensive that it was impossible. But here they are reworking the fucking intro. And it's the right call to make.
Absolutely. It made these episodes timeless, the whole package. Speaking of the whole package, when we come back to the episode, our act one has something you and I immediately identified as something we have to talk about. And that is a captain's log that is being narrated by Captain Maximilian Forrest. So we have a not Archer in command. Archer is first officer, and not an Admiral Forrest, but a Captain Forrest. So we have spoken of Von Armstrong, veteran Trek actor, in reference mostly to Enterprise, since he's a regular here, whereas in his other roles it's a one-off character. But this man spent several hours, many times, underneath the tender ministrations of the makeup chair to play some Klingon or some Vidian or Hirogen or Cardassian or Vulcan along the way. And in these episodes at the end of runs, they tend to be kind of like senior week for the writers and producers. And it's not uncommon for them to sort of do some wish fulfillment for people who have been workers for them. Sometimes they'll get lines. Sometimes they'll have like a bit of a focus in an episode of this background
as character. As was the case playing. For Smoldering Catcher, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And here we have Von Armstrong, who you got to wonder if it was just like he got called up. It was like, hey, buddy, listen, you never got to be the dashing action hero. You never got to be in command of the Enterprise. You never got to
even
go
be
down
on the Enterprise.
You never got to go down gloriously in battle. And you definitely never got to make out with the hot chick. How would you like to do all of those things? Come on back, Vaughn. We got one more aces experience for you. Linda Park has been brushing her teeth all day. She's going to be making out with a lot of people this week. All right. And she's like, we asked her, we were like, Linda, you willing to fit in Vaughn into your schedule? And she's like, oh, listen, I'm already making out with Scott a bunch this week anyway. So like, what's one more, right? Like, give me some fixident and we'll just get up in there and we'll make sure it's nice and fresh.
Very happy to see him back. And that was a big surprise just overall. Like, I did not expect to see Vaughn Armstrong.
Yeah.
Anywhere near Enterprise this late in the season after they killed him off in the Tom Clancy trilogy. Stroke of genius bringing him in as the obstacle that Archer was going to have to work around.
Yeah.
And great plot conflict mechanic in there. And just, yeah.
They make him very interesting in the plot in that he's somewhat reasonable. Probably like the only protagonist in the episode, really. He does ultimately sacrifice his life for other people. Which you would not expect from essentially anybody else. Specifically does so for Hoshi. And he gets to go down like a champ, right? Like he gets to bat the cycle on the last episode.
Absolutely. So let's go through real quick and talk about everybody's mirror counterparts. Also, I like the fact that at least as far as this episode goes, I don't know what happens next episode, but this is mirror people only. There's no standard universe people bleeding into this thing. You've got obviously Forrest, who is the captain. There's rumor that Archer should have had it, but Forrest has a lot of admiral friends, and that's him. Underneath him, you've got Archer, who is a mostly loyal subordinate who is true to the Empire and thinks he's got the chance to end the war, which I'm assuming is with the Klingons.
No, it's an internal rebellion.
Oh, really?
Yes.
How interesting. Does that get...
Yes. Well, you'll see more next week.
Very interesting. So have the Klingons already been subdued, or are they just not dealing with each other?
It's just not coming up in this story. Like they said, like when Forrest is talking about the battle, he does say the rebels. The rebellion is how he phrases the military conflict.
Because kind of have the Federation here. It's just all Terran Empire, right? The Vulcans have been conquered. The Tellarites, obviously. Correct. The Noblians are in there. Didn't see any Andorians. But you got Archer, then you've got Hoshi. Heavy emphasis on Ho in this one.
Yeah, so it is a mirroring universe tradition that there's always gotta be a Ho. This is all the way back to TOS, but DS9 episodes were particularly notorious for the fact that every single mirror universe woman was just a hoe. That's how they were evil. So we gotta honor certain tropes and
traditions.
Hoshi is definitely the designated hoe.
I would say T'Pol's right up there too. Is Hoshi actually a member of the crew? I mean, she's in a uniform. You never really see her on the bridge.
She's still the translator. She's still a communications officer.
She's in a weird spot because she kind of ends up under house arrest. Before we get too much deeper off of it, we saw bitch Hoshi, mean bitch Hoshi, reared her first head in the Space Ghost episode, right?
Yeah, kind of.
That's where we first got like the, what if Linda Park was playing someone who was not nice and bubbly, and instead you had someone who's vicious? And that is, I think, what her wheelhouse is as an actress, is somebody who is mean-spirited. And no, there was like her doing a little bit of rumor mongering too, like season one with Phlox. Like, this character is about, cut the hoe stuff out, right?
Right.
This character is 400 times more interesting than standard Hoshi.
Oh, it definitely.
As bad as
Reed is. There's something going on here, yeah. Like, unfortunately, the best parts of Hoshi's character basically just stopped happening after the second season.
Well, her being mean and manipulative and condescending works great. She knows what she's doing there. I don't know what that says about her as a person. I'm sure she's lovely off camera.
Oh, I mean, I'm sure she is. Linda Park, though, she's a trooper because she leans into being the femme fatale for this episode with 100% conviction. You know, like, I am a potential sexual conquest for powerful men, and I will use them and manipulate them and craft their desire for me in a way that helps me profit, right? Like,
and I keep a knife between my shoulder blades at all times. What other option does she have? She has been fed absolutely nothing of substance since arguably her peak in character development and screen time, which was fighting the Zindi reptilians.
Yeah.
Brainwashing.
The brainworms in 0 hour. Yeah. She did not have an episode this season. This is the closest you get is the Mirror Universe episodes.
Yeah. What option do you have but to throw yourself in 100% because the ego demands.
Linda, we finally have an episode for you. Good news. You don't have to bring much to wardrobe. Like, you're just going to be hanging out in lingerie 60% of your scenes.
Mm-hmm. Good news. Your shirt's not going to fall off. Bad news. You don't even get a shirt to start off with.
Yeah, we're not starting you with one. Also, there is going to be a grease man on scene for when you're doing your bedroom pillow talk with Scott this week. So, you know. Do get your skin routine done before that.
You've got a very interesting choice to recast Malcolm Reed, not as Starfleet security, but just straight up a Mako. He is now occupying the role as Major Hayes. He is very similar to Standard Reed, I think.
He is, except, well, no, I was going to say more effective, but not really, because the ship does get, in fact, taken back over under his watch. So really, how good was he? But he fits more as a military officer. We were correct all along about that. Love that Mayweather is one of his goons. That's him in his natural habitat.
Real quick, I prefer this version of Reed to actual Reed, like removing the thin veneer of maybe I should care about this guy and just being like, this dude's a slimy merc who is not trustworthy and is a sadist. And he's using his Wesley Crusher levels child prodigy intellect to make torture chambers in his free time.
It's true.
I'll take him over Standard Reed still.
Still an improvement. Still better.
At least this guy knows how to hold a gun, right?
He holds a gun and I hate him. And now I can't. I'm allowed to hate him. You know, I'm supposed to.
Mayweather, with that hairpiece and the earring in his ear, looks like, he looks like Simon Phoenix, Wesley Snipes in Demolition Man.
He does.
He's a Mako. He is not a helmsman. It would be interesting to think what his career trajectory was. Would he still grow up a boomer? You know, what has happened that has brought him into this life of military service, which clearly he excels at. But yeah, man, I'm just waiting for him to have that scene where he's got the blowtorch on the gas and he's like, set your ass on fire.
I'll just do one roundhouse kick and I'll totally buy in.
Let me jump back up to Archer here real quick. Archer's defining evil characteristic is that he now has the haircut of one of the Dick's Sporting Good villains. From Rogue Planet.
He has the haircut of your stepdad. You know, like every stepdad, whoever your stepdad is, he's got that haircut.
He has angry white guy hair now.
He does look like a jarhead, though. Like, they actually did a good job of making him look like a military man. You know?
His performance is the worst out of this entire lot. And I don't know what the hell is going on with the direction from James Conway. If he was just, you know what, Scott, do whatever you want. Like, if he just gave up trying to fight. But it is awful. And as good as Archer has been recently in terms of portrayal, like, maybe there is just this limited cone of what Scott Bakula can accomplish. And that is, like, well-intentioned, good guy. But unlike season 1 and 2 Archer, it's like well-intentioned, good guy who is competent and effective.
Right. Yeah, I got the impression he just didn't get it, right? because instead of being sinister, he seemed kind of cartoonish, and it didn't quite work.
He felt like Jonathan Archer out of season one lying. Right? So maybe even, gosh, by the time they pulled the shit with Degra, that was a pretty good portrayal he had as, you know, the, hey, we used to be cellmates or whatever, right?
Right, right, of course.
But if you go to Con Aramar, where he's kind of like hokey and making up this lie as they go along, so...
Boggs. Space Boggs, yeah.
He's trying to trick Space Boggs into leaving. Like, that's still like this hokey, like, I'm a guy who's a straight shooter, good boy, and not a great actor, and now I'm trying to act like something I absolutely am not. That's what it feels like.
He basically was just like, be louder, be gruffer. That's it. That's where I'm going to go.
Wiggle your neck around more.
Yeah, like everybody else found a different lane to get in. Like Hoshi went from bubbly, if mildly over it, to seductress. You had Reed go from stuffy to slime ball. You had Mayweather go from just goofy enthusiasm to... Simon Phoenix, just silent killer. To Paul doesn't change much, but
to Paul,
yeah, there's a big change.
Last,
And then there's Trip, who we don't really see till halfway through the episode, and I like how he's different in that instead of this aggressive professionalism and endless energy, he's kind of apathetic and fatalistic. As a consequence of all of his radiation burns and likelihood of an early death.
He was one of my favorites. That character encapsulates the shittiness of the Terran Empire along like Warhammer lines of just like, no, some people are going to suffer and die. And that's just part of the equation of space travel. And they are a cost that we are happy to pay. This guy's probably as smart as regular Trip, but he's grotesque. I love that the radiation burns on his face look the same pattern as what Pike has in the original series.
Yeah, with the droopy eye. Yeah.
Droopy eye and like the skin that's ripped, but then like the it's like a scaly skin down the scar. You know, the defining quality about him is whereas standard Trip would not bang to Paul during Ponfar, this guy was all too happy to jump on it.
Not good guy Tucker. This is
blackmail her with it, right? Them having to wear radiation badges in engineering because the plating on the warp core is shitty and thin and kills people. Ultimately, you know, the guy's loyal as far as we know, but still,
he's fatalistic though. He's just like, he's doing his job, but unlike the real Tucker who has endless enthusiasm, he has a sort of, I'm going to do this until it finally grinds me into ashes. Cause that's my fate, which
flocks, which
sadistic murderer
gleefully. So, professional yet unethical. You know, this guy could be over on the, was the Voyager ship, the Equinox?
The Equinox. Yeah, he could have been the Equinox doctor. He has the right attitude.
His uniform was interesting. And maybe that's just the medical smock he's in, but like half the scenes you get with Phlox, he's like dissecting house cats and rats and God knows what else. Like, I was going to say completely opposite than Phlox, but early season Phlox was, detached and, you know, a little vicious at times. I thought it would have been cool, I think, if Reed just blatantly was wearing a Section 31 outfit instead of being a Mako. That would have been an interesting angle to play, I think.
Well, they're supposed to be covert. So even if it was a legitimate organization in this universe, it still would be like this. You don't have a CIA badge, you know, like you have an FBI badge.
No, but you could have Gestapo. And true. I think that would be
like something, a more sinister version of the Makos.
And then is there anybody else we're missing or is it time to talk about T'Pol?
Just finally time to talk about T'Pol.
They've had her in some very flattering space elf stuff before, but like between the long hair and those fucking abs, like, man, I saw her on screen. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those Professor Disco outfits, for being the dumb crushed velvet cat suits they are, like, take anything that they were trying to do with like hot chicks on screen in the Orion Slave Girls episode, and Jolene Blaylock blew them out of the fucking water. It's like Jolene's sitting there on set watching these Orions dance around. She's like, listen, I'm not going to get one upped on my own fucking show. What's the next episode we got going on here? All right, take that uniform, cut it in half. I didn't do all these goddamn sit-ups for four seasons, and we're not going to show my abs one time.
She did so many stomach crunches in 2005.
My abs hurt.
like this woman was in unbelievably perfect physical shape for this moment, and you cannot help but respect it. Like, you wanted to look good, and you fucking achieved it. Well done.
And that's not to take anything away from Linda Park either. I mean, she looked amazing too.
No, but everyone's good. At this show, from beginning to end, what do we say? They're very beautiful. Everyone is beautiful on the show. Everyone looks good with their shirt off. Everyone stayed very in shape. We don't have any like Tom Paris tummy. We don't have any we don't have any puffing on the part of Commander Riker. You know, these are people who lived in the gym for the whole course of their contracts.
To be fair, you know, all those other guys had to worry about late season shit 7 years in. These guys only got up to four, you know. Everybody else was still probably looking pretty good around season four, too. Take her looking scorching hot and set it off to the side. Jolene Blaylock understands Vulcans. She put great amounts of research in. I think more so than that role even realistically demanded. Like, she brought it up on her own. She has done a great job with facial movements and body language relaying the Vulcan attitude, right? As she was able to go unhinged because of her Trillium D addiction, further highlight what Vulcans are about by creating taboo with it. And seeing her be able to take that knowledge and use it in this episode as, what does evil Vulcan really look like? What happens when you have Vulcans that are still loyal, kind of, that are still business first, but have them just be fucking ruthless where they're using mind melds as weapons, using sex as weapons, getting people hurt, betraying.
They are learning from their environment. You know, they are learning how to use the weapons before them.
I love that in this, the Vulcans were conquered, that Archer's quick to put her in her place and remind her that, you know, because of her blood, she will always be a slave, despite, you know, giving her authority on the ship. Which, not to jump too far ahead, do you think Archer was promoting her for his own reasons, or do you think that T'Pol jumped him and used a mind meld to force him to promote her?
I would rather not speculate on things where we've got a whole nother episode with so much plot in it to discuss when it comes to, like, so let's hold that, right? We got more to see. So we've discussed, we're setting the table a lot. We're halfway through this episode. We've really not talked about its plot because really the plot is very simple. It's just that you get the time to kind of process all these massive character changes and understanding, okay, we're in the mirror universe. We're not going to explain why we're here, right? This has nothing to do with the show that we have previously watched, as you noted. In fact, to the degree it has anything to do with Star Trek as it's already been published, it's just that it's in the mirror universe and we're tying in a species callback that we haven't used in 50 years to explain what happened to a particular thing that occurred there.
We're also doing this late season. There's five episodes left, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you're taking two of those slots to put into something that is completely irrelevant to anything else out of the past three seasons.
It's the last shot they got, man. It's like they knew by the time they were making this episode, they were fucking done.
And they also knew that this was going to be the big gun, right? This is one that's going to go down and on the all time greats here. So, amazing.
Yeah. So the plot is we're seeing all this unfold. You know, we know Forrest is with Hoshi. We know Hoshi actually cares about Forrest. They seem to actually have a genuine relationship with each other. We know that in the mirror universe, Hoshi explicitly did in fact leave Jonathan Archer. Like, she said so. Like, I left you for a more successful man, and it's bothered you ever since. We know that whatever Archer's history was, he wasn't as successful in the mirror universe. He didn't get command, and he's gunning for it, and he's gunning for it because he's got a hot tip for something that might be personally profitable for his career. And first he tries to get Archer tries to get Forrest to investigate it, and when he refuses, he decides, well, why don't we do a little mirror universe mutiny to action? Just go ahead and take the ship and get the plot going.
Do you think that Archer is doing this for purely selfish reasons, or do you think that Archer is really a patriot who truly in his heart believes that the Empire needs this?
I am blessed to know the answer to that question because, of course, I've seen the other half of this. So let me ask you, what is your theory?
My theory is that Archer is a true believer, and that's a trait that's shared between both. Because, you know, they're in all of this stuff, there has to be more than just physical similarities between these characters. It has to be enough there to be like, okay, this is the person, but they're wrong, but they're evil, but there's something different. And I think the true believer visionary is still there for Archer. There's conversations between Hoshi and Forrest where, you know, Hoshi's bragging about how great they've been doing. And Forrest admits that the last battle was heavily propaganda pushed, that the Empire lost, what, 12 ships?
Yeah, that, a whole bunch.
You know, it's very yesterday's Enterprise. Like, hey, the Federation's making it seem like we're doing great, but things are bad and we are desperate. And if that's what the real vibe is there, and Archer's exposed to that, then circumventing orders and going all out on this makes a lot of sense.
So he executes on a mutiny with Reed's assistance and Mayweather's assistance, Wesley primarily. Snipes. Right. Simon Phoenix. And he actually promotes Simon Phoenix to be his personal bodyguard. Porthos in this universe is a Rottweiler, not a happy beagle, a growly Rottweiler. And there is some interesting sort of politics on the ship of jockeying for, is this a real thing? What is Archer up to? You don't really get a sense of T'Pol's loyalty. You know, Hoshi makes her move with a knife and kind of gives up on it and then bangs him anyway.
Like, that's just foreplay, Joe. That's just foreplay.
Yeah, it's mirror universe foreplay, absolutely.
No, that's just foreplay.
And, you know, there's a sabotage on the ship. Ultimately, Archer starts torturing Trip over it, which, you know, like, in this version in the mirror universe, Archer and Trip are the opposite of what they are in the Prime universe, which is they don't know each other at all. Like, he starts questioning, like, you were put on the ship because Admiral Back recommended you. They have like a pretty distant professional relationship.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think there is some connections there. Trip's like, you know, I've always been loyal to you, blah, blah, blah. So I choose.
That's true. He does say that while he's being tortured.
My favorite thing about this entire episode, even more so than Jolene Blaylock's abs, is how absolutely rotten every single person is to every other person around them. And is such the antithesis of Star Trek, which always boils down to good friends doing the right thing against insurmountable odds in space. I can't speak to what exactly happens on DS9 since that's a darker adventure, but
that's still mostly correct, by the way.
You know, and it has to be that TOS, Voyager, Enterprise. It's good people who always have each other's back. And in this, it's just rotten fucks doing rotten shit to each other, starting and frequently being torture, seduction, manipulation, borderline rape, fucking mutiny and backstabbing, fighting. And then despite just really reprehensible behavior, then they'll all turn around and sit down at the fucking table and be like, okay, about the mission.
All right. Yeah. Business time. It's like, put all of the crimes we have been committing against each other for the first 40 minutes of this episode aside. We have shit to do, right?
We have, not only do we have shit to do, but we are going to be incredibly effective at what we are doing.
Archer's been tortured for 10 hours. Trip was tortured for 4 hours. Reed, an indeterminate amount of time. Hoshi's been run through by two different people at that table that day. Like, just so much.
Archer beat up. Archer conducted a mutiny and then beat his boss up in a prison fight. Before going in the torture chamber. The torture chamber we keep talking about, by the way, that thing gets featured in Discovery, which was fun.
It's also in, obviously, the TOS episode, Mirror Mirror. That's like the first thing you see as well.
How funny that not only does Reed get to invent shields, he's also invented the pain tube. That pain tube specifically, did you recognize it?
Is it the same tube from Cold Station 12?
It absolutely is.
Of course. You already have a tube. It is a tube you had someone die in. It's just right there. You don't have to have props build a new one.
Where are we going to get a tube that is man-sized and brings ruin? Hey, what about that Peach H, the HVAC duct? Because now what I'm thinking is that there has been other Mirror Universe crossover and some Terran engineers got kicked over and ended up working for Starfleet and designed Cold Station 12.
Right.
Also a majority of the systems that blow up and burn people's faces.
It's off. That makes so much sense. The Federation is such gullible good do-gooders that these Snidely Whiplash scientists just kind of snuck into positions and no one ever questioned why they started putting IEDs under every Starfleet panel or why this disease cold storage facility required a test tube.
No, it's not intentional to hurt people. It's just corner cutting and very effective. Imagine, like, that's the Lower Decks episode. Maybe that should have been our skit. Maybe it will be our skit one day where it's like, you're sitting there and be like, ah, fuck, there's Doug. Man, you know, Doug's got some real solid math, but just look at the way he's hunched over, those beady eyes, the way the lights always flicker on him. You know, Doug, there's a rumor, Doug's Mirror Universe. No. Yeah, dude, look, all this shit, his systems... All it takes is a poke. You hit a fucking asteroid, 9 times out of 10, Doug's monitors blow up. And why would he have to use the acid instead of electricity back there? It just burns people's faces off. Doug's easy. Trust me, bro.
You know, I understand he says that they're historic, but no one should have a knife collection that large. Okay? He looks like a fucking truck stop in Tennessee over there. All right? All right, that's not okay. All right. And it's the looking into the middle distance with a slight sinister grin. No one does that except if you're from the Mirror Universe.
Look at his mustache, man, with the goatee. And the guy eats gawk specifically because it's the only thing he can bring on premise that's still alive because he claims a religious exemption. Something's fucked up with that guy.
So the biggest revelation before they kind of get to the end, where the really exciting stuff happens. They could have
a cloaking device on the ship that wasn't hooked up for whatever fucking reason.
Well, it's the Suliban one. So apparently in the Mirror Universe, they also encountered the Suliban and got one of their ships that cloaked and carried it around for a while, just like they did on Enterprise.
And everybody forgot about it until the one time you needed it conveniently for a plot.
So you know what? They do function by some of the same rules. Hmm. So they have the cloak. They go to use it so that they can execute on this mission. And in the process of this happening, eventually they do bust out Captain Forrest, and it looks like it's all the Vulcan crew members. So apparently Forrest, who again is the only one that comes out of this that's actually not a bad person. He does nothing wrong to anyone except allow someone to be tortured in front of him, really. And then torture the people who, you know, took over a ship, which is almost just kind of more just than anything.
I also did love Reed's sliminess. They were like, oh, okay, you see the Tellarite in there getting tortured in the Cold Station 12 poison tube. And you're like, oh man, that sucks. These humans are just, you know, terrible people torturing all these other races. And then you see the Tellarites wearing a fucking crewman outfit. And they're like, by the way, what did that guy do? Oh, who knows? This is probably late for a shift. You know, these fucking Tellarites. It's always something with these guys. Just the casual racism.
Well executed. And the coup, the counter coup, kind of shoot at each other a little bit. None of that's all that exciting, to be honest, except for that it plays out in such a way that they end up going through the mission anyway, and everyone just kind of has to be released and on their best behavior.
The interesting part of that was to Paul brainwashing Trip to sabotage the ship and then wiping his memory. Like, boy, what a skill set to have. Like, you just got access
to dominate now. That was to Paul revealing herself. You know, that's her not being a good person, right? Like, I'm going to just psychically alter your memories and make you sabotage the ship and not know it happened.
And also, I tricked you into all that by making you think we were going to go hump. So
just salt in the wound.
Uh-huh. Fuck you and your lazy eye.
But the coolest stuff here is the effects. And it begins when we actually find our first Tholian. So Archer finds a Tholian ship, disables it. It tries to blow itself up. And they transport it into the decon chamber. But of course, a Tholian requires extraordinarily hot temperatures to survive. And this is the very first time in Star Trek history a Tholian is actually seen on screen, like, moving around, right? It's basically a crystalline version of the Space Mewtwos, you know? It's kind of like a quadruped, kind of looks like a Zerg almost, except with mirror skin. Very cool. I love the concept of the Tholians.
It's not awful CGI. It's an absurd-looking thing.
Yeah, it just looks manifestly alien.
Yeah, and I like the fact that it can generate a harmonic alert just by vibrating itself. I love Phlox's ability to showcase his evil at the expense of the Tholian by torturing it repeatedly. Like, the line that, you know, encapsulates the whole thing for him is, "Would you kindly die?"
And is perfect for him. And I also really like that the nature of the Tholians and their inability to really interact with human technology because of the vast difference in environmental requirements makes it so that the plot happened, because they had to employ humanoid species to take apart the USS Defiant, and because they couldn't do it themselves because they would die. I mean, it's just a perfect additional complication that allows someone like Archer to find out what's going on.
Flimsy as fuck, but it works. Again, that's all you need to have is a little bit of a bridge. Is it that ridiculous to think that the Terran Empire wouldn't have an extensive spy network, that Archer wouldn't be plugged into it somehow, and that we wouldn't arrive at this, reason for them wanting to go deep into Tholian space to investigate rumors that they have possession of some sort of a Terran vehicle, potentially from the future? So Archer takes over. He sets the ship to go to the coordinates where the Tholian base is. He has Hoshi, who is kind of working with him. Like, you know, he doesn't just outright kill him. Again, I love the history between them. It's enough that I got to worry about you stabbing me, but we can reach a bridge, and we've got this history, so I'm not just flat out killing you. What was the communication? Oh, that's my backup plan, which will later be, I'm going to divulge what my plan is to the Starfleet admirals. So just in case something happens, I'll be able to force Forrest's hand on this.
So when they do arrive on site and activate the cloak, The coolest part of this, of course, is the follow-up that it represents to the Tholian Web, which I've already mentioned, but let me explain a bit more. Third season of TOS, famous episode in which we have the introduction of the Tholians as a species. Enterprise is trying to find the USS Defiant, another Constitution-class starship that they had lost contact with weeks prior. They find it, and they find it exactly in the manner of the disarray that you see in this episode, up to and including the note that the captain's neck had been snapped. The episode then happens, the Tholians show up, they are really assholes about punctuality, and they try to use this web thing to capture the Enterprise, blah blah blah, and Spock and McCoy have to outsmart them while arguing with each other, because Spock's technically in charge, because Kirk got left on the Defiant when it phased back out of the universe, and Spock had to calculate, like, oh, this is exactly where it's going to show back up, so that we can grab him before it phases out forever. So that all happens. They get Kirk back, but the Defiant just vanishes, and no one knows where it goes.
What?
Like, the episode ends, and the Defiant... Spock says in the episode, it went into a different universe.
Are we going to go into, in the Mirror Darkly part two, are they going to go into what killed the crew?
I think that they will a little, if I recall. Essentially, it's the disturbances in space drove them insane. So it was like space actual madness. Factual space madness. It's not important to the plot, so I don't remember if they mention it in this. But we actually get an answer to the entire plot of that episode. Why did that happen? Because the Tholians of the past accidentally created a vortex between universes by donating a cobalt device in the shadow of a dead star or something, like some weird gravitational techno babble, and they opened a doorway and they sent a distress signal, see if anyone would come through, and these fucking chuckle fucks were stupid enough to do it.
Shout out to whatever was that episode, Conspiracy?
Or the Bugs?
No, the Voyager episode that basically had Seven of Nine believe that.
The Voyager Conspiracy. Yeah.
Which, you know, why did Voyager have tri-cobalt devices?
Of course. Why do they have military-grade warheads for assaulting space stations? Why did they have those? They were on a hunt for terrorists. It was a legitimate question.
Nope. They're there to conquer the Delta Quadrant and, you know, lay the seeds for Federation expansion through force. Real quick, in original series, how many Constitution classes were there?
Not many. That was actually a major kind of point there in the show in the background. And it's something, if you ever watch Star Trek Continues, the web series, that becomes the plot point of that series, of the dwindling nature of the Constitution class ships and what's happening to them. But I think there's like a dozen, period.
So there's a lot of Starfleet vessels. We don't really get... Do they show alternate vessels, or is Reliant really the first time you see another Starfleet vessel of note?
Correct. It's the Reliant.
So there's a bunch of other stuff. Constitutions like galaxies encapsulate the best Starfleet's able to muster, and it's a limited quantity. So these things are big fucking deals, and the fact that what's essentially a top-of-the-line vessel from 100 years in the future falling back in the hands is a real peach.
Yeah, and the Tholians don't know how to use what they have because it's not built for them. So they're just kind of stuck poking at it and disassembling its parts and trying to understand it, but not being very effective at it because it's such alien technology to them.
It's worth noting that during the briefing meeting where Forrest is telling people what the mission's going to be, that nobody at the table really seems to buy that any of this is plausible, and that Archer is the only person who thinks that there's really a shot at this. Archer and the Admiral, who finally got the message and said, no, go figure this thing out anyways. So when they show up and it's revealed on screen that, hey, this isn't actually a Tholian trap, and there really is some sort of future Earth vehicle over there that's been carbon dated, it's real juicy. Forrest is like, hey, entire bridge crew, main cast, you're all going to go over there. You, my plot armor, are going to leave this ship and me alone with just my concubine. What's the worst that can happen? Also, hey, real quick, Jolene Blaylock's abs. If you could do us a favor and make sure that Archer doesn't make it back over here because he's a treacherous fuck, that would be great.
Well, good thing I've been to the gym as often as I've been. I can pull this caper off, says Jolene Blaylock's abs. So yeah, at the most of the bridge crew heads over. It's just Phlox, Hoshi, of the main cast who are still on Enterprise.
Porthos.
And then what should happen is that the Tholian that they have been keeping in their containment in the containment zone, which is I guess just the
decon
chamber.
Yeah,
no wakes back up for him. Starts trying to send the transmission again. Phlox does kill him, but not before that transmission was enough to give away Enterprise's location, and they throw the web around it. They constrict it. They just start shooting at it. And yeah, Varn Armstrong gets to go down gloriously with his ship, having saved most of his crew on lifeboats, except the ones that get shot.
Lots of them get shot. Some of them hit the webs and disintegrate. Everybody over on the Defiant is wandering the delightfully retro hallways. This is the biggest Constitution class set that Paramount has created since original series. You got dead crewmen wearing original series outfits all over the place to get up to the bridge, which has been stripped down to a certain degree. You got a lot of exposed hatches
with mission specific patches for a ship that's different than Enterprise, because that was still the custom back then. Famously, it is Enterprise itself and its success in its 5-year mission that makes the Delta the Starfleet symbol. But before that, each Constitution class ship had its own insignia.
Well, there's a note in the Memory Alpha that practice was supposed to be discontinued on Gene Roddenberry's authority by the time that this showed up, and they kind of went in the strictest sense. Defiant should not have had unique mission patches, but obviously I think it works better with them having it. So they're on the bridge. They get things powered back up relatively easy. There is a note that, hey, there's other humanoids on the ship, one of them being reptilian. I wonder if that's going to be a Gorn. Oh my gosh, look what's going on screen. Oh no, they blew up the Enterprise. There she goes. Gee, I wonder
if only we're in a battleship that's 100 years more advanced.
If only we could pull a Catherine Janeway and whoop the shit out of alien ass with future tech.
So just it sets the table perfectly for part two. You just want to keep watching. I don't have much bad to say. It's just so much fun to watch a bunch of actors really have a good time with the prospect of their characters being radically different than the way before they were before, and kind of just getting to go with it. The writers obviously enjoyed putting this together. Is Jolene Blaylock's abs being a little exploited? Yes, but at the same time, I don't think she thinks they were. I think she was happy to have them like out and proud. Linda Park was probably just happy to have that much screen time.
You might not have anything bad to say about this, but John Billingsley and Connor Trinneer were not fans of the two-parter. Billingsley called the episode banal, and Trinneer described them as pandering.
Shut up, nerd.
Fuck off.
Get the fuck out of here.
Fuck. How are you going to have a Star Trek podcast? How are you going to try and talk to the fans when you can't get behind this? Like, how can you not just be like, hey, man, this is a lot of fun. All the juicy shit that they've thrown Phlox, especially this season, just great stuff. The focus that was on them and all the augments stuff. Like, you've gotten, I don't think there's any argument. These two guys specifically have had more good character development, growth, deep Absolutely. Introspective shit.
Yeah.
And then what? You're going to get a crusty Victor Frankenstein and, a maimed Dr. Hyde. And you're going to sit there, meh, I didn't like this because my character was comically mean. Meh.
give me a break. Yeah, I'm with you. Like, when you can really consider that these are the two guys that have benefited the most from the best that Enterprise has had to offer for their acting talents, to poo-poo this, which is just a fucking good time for everyone else for a change. Yeah. Is it a little pandering? Sure. Sure. We're not selling it short. Linda Park barely wears a shirt. Like, it's a bit pandery. It's definitely going for it, but it's fun. Enjoy the ride, okay? Take a look back at those 60s episodes and tell me that it was that much different than what you're watching right now. You know,
just fun. My last entry in my notes, how exciting. And that's not me being facetious. You watch Star Trek and you know every fucking time that maybe once a series does a main cast member die, by and large, everybody's going to be there next week with their asses sitting in the same seats, and the ship is still going to be there for the most part. And, you know, you got to ride this some degree of homeostasis episode after episode. You jump into What If stuff, Yesterday's Enterprise, this Dark Mirror shit, anything's on the table. Anybody can die. Any ship can get blown up. Watching these characters act radically different than when you're normally accustomed to seeing, getting in fights, betraying each other, murdering, backstabbing, all that other stuff. Like, this is riveting. I haven't had this much. And four has had some fucking bangers. And normally the bangers have to come in the form of like, man, here's some real deep Star Trek lore that just
this
has
not
wild.
Deep. No. Yeah. It's a different kind of experience. And that's why it's fun.
It's fun. It's still thought it's not deep, but again, there's enough stuff. You're like, man, look at the way these guys just acted. They would have never done that. Mm-hmm. Boy, is this good. Boy, am I enjoying this. Boy, I can't wait for more. I'm enjoying watching all this. And exactly what Brand said, like, I would love, I'm sitting here saying this, and yet Discovery gave us almost a fucking season worth of Mirror Universe shit. I would take a season of the Enterprise cast doing Mirror Universe shtick.
I mean, happily. I would take a season of the antagonist being the Mirror Universe versions of them and getting it in pieces. I think we definitely learned the lesson in Discovery, amongst many others, that you can have too much of a good thing. You can have just too much chocolate. So I don't agree that it should just be this, but there was clearly a way to actually tell some compelling villain stories by making them the Mirror Universe versions of the crew and you getting to know them.
Jump back to season one and us talking about who the Shadow Man was that was funding the Suliban. I think one of my suggestions was Mirror Universe Archer. Give me this thing, make that him, makes a whole temporal Cold War work.
Right. Like, that is something Mirror Archer would probably do. You're absolutely right. That would have been more fitting than it being just Future Archer. But what it is great. There's more to watch. I go ahead and just read the basics. Don't read the explanation. I don't even want to read the
capsule. It's going to be more Mirror Universe. I'm down with it. It's more by Mike Sussman. Stories Manny Coto. Marvin Rush is going to be the director. Interesting behind the scenes for Mirror Darkly Part 1. Sussman didn't know who even was going to write Mirror Darkly Part 2, which is a crazy way to write the first part. Yeah. Manny Coto was in the process of getting married in Venice, and he is faxing pages of scripts over for Coto to read, which is like, come on, guys. Dude, this is 2005.
I mean, 2005.
I graduated college by then, all right? Gmail was a thing.
Gmail was a thing, but like the creative process, like, you know, if you were in Italy, maybe like there might be a internet cafe somewhere, but that's the only way you're getting access to digital information. It would probably actually be more reliable to fax to Europe.
Business center.
Yeah. That's actually probably every hotel had a fax machine, but probably not every one of them had an internet connected computer.
Long distance charges for faxing. On a
four, oh, sure, it was atrociously expensive. But what's not atrociously expensive is enjoying this podcast.
Enjoying that badass intro.
Yes. Thanks again to Ian. That was fucking amazing. Better than we deserve. See you next week.